Blog Talk Radio.
How you doing out there today? Welcome to Applause Radio Show. I'm Joanne Barton, and alongside me, as always, is my wonderful friend, Mr. John Arricchio. How are you today, sir?
Good. How's everybody doing out there on the sweltering hot Wednesday?
Oh, it is hot. Yes, it is. I have to call Steve, but before I do, let's just say thank you to our sponsors, the High Bar and Bistro in Garfield, New Jersey, Precious Memory Video in Kintnersville, Pennsylvania, KWB Wines in South Africa, Tees for the Times and Other Stuff in Clifton, New Jersey. And hold on, please. Hold on 1 second.
Syntech. We had a slight mishap there.
Syntech Productions in Anoka Harbor, New Jersey, Oleander Public Relations in Texas, Take a Break from Cancer.org for Pete's Sake, Joey Mag's Hot Dog Truck and Cafe in Harrison, New Jersey. I was going to call our guest, but he actually just called us. Tonight we have with us Steve Taibbi. He's the author of Grateful Guilt, Living in the Shadow of My Heart. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Joanne. I'm enjoying a cup of coffee while we do so.
Good, good. Here's John on the line. I was going to call you, but you saved me the time. Thank you so much. I have to ask you, your name has been haunting me since we booked you. Are you related to the Taibbi who did New York News on, was it Channel 4? Was it Mike Taibbi?
That would be my brother.
Oh, okay, I thought so. When I heard the name, I said, I wonder if they're related. Is he still on Channel 4?
No, he retired. He's living in L.A.
Oh, okay. Well, I've been dying to talk to you. Not only am I interested about your book, but there is so much other. Your background is just amazing. And I have to apologize to you and our listeners. I'm so sorry. I recently had surgery, so I'm not myself. If we have to cut the show short, I hope you all understand. I'm going to do the best I can to make it through. So Steve's book is called Grateful Guilt, Living in the Shadow of My Heart. And I can imagine that you do have some guilt, because to get that heart, somebody has to die.
Yeah, and I have two. I have two of them. I've had two heart transplants now.
Wow. How old were you when you got the first one? Because you were very young when you started with your health issues.
I was 50. 47. I was 47, and I was that when I got married. It's hard to tell. They were both near death incidences.
Right.
My last one was 4 years ago, and the one before that was 15 years ago.
And why'd you have to have two? The first one was not good? It didn't take?
No, because 15 years, I mean, most heart transplants don't last that long. People think last forever, but they don't. I had no what they call matches for my heart. And they had to put it in anyway because it was that or I would die. So they gave me the heart that they could. I didn't have the enzyme matches for that one. But that heart lasted for 15 years, and that was a long time.
Yeah.
But they eventually reject. And that heart rejected after 15 years, and they reject by doing – they make you know how you have coronary artery disease where you form plaque in your arteries.
Mm-hmm.
There's transplant coronary artery disease. There's no plaque, but the vessels swell, and it's the same thing as the plaque. Mm-hmm. It's the vessels close down, but not because of or the way you're eating. It's because the heart is rejecting.
Mm-hmm.
And I had 5 stents in my first transplanted heart, but after a while, there was just it was just on its way out.
Wow.
And that heart lasted 9 days short of 15 years exactly.
Wow. But you had a lot of health issues as a child as well. I mean, this wasn't something that just came out of the blue, right? I mean,
well, actually, this is a little weird, Joy. You're not going to believe this. When I was 5 years old, I was diagnosed with something called ASD, atrial septum defect.
Mm.
And that used to be known as a hole in the heart. They still call it that nowadays.
Right.
But that was always for children because it's a birth defect. And the survival rate for the operations of that day was 50% if you had one operation.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an operation when I was 5, and I survived.
Wow.
After my parents were told I had about a year to live.
Wow.
And I survived that operation. But then they were told he has 2 holes in the heart. We found it when we were in there fixing the first one.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't think I'd survive that much of an operation. And they said, if he makes it till we think he's strong enough, then we'll do the other one. They did the other one, but at that time, no one in the world had lived through 2 open heart surgeries for ASD repair. I was the first.
Wow.
And then they told my parents, well, he made it through that, but he won't get past 10. Then they were told, then as I got older, when I was 16, I was told I had a year to live. And that one almost came true. I had a major heart incident on my 17th birthday and had the whole out-of-body experience. And then I got through that, and they told me, well, my doctors told me, you'll be lucky if you make 30.
Right.
But I just started chasing life with a hammer. I didn't want to hear about it. And still started my own businesses and everything and did everything I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day the doctor says to me, well, we don't know what you did, but somehow you beat it. And then I contracted a virus, an unknown virus, and that's what killed my heart. Had nothing to do with any of the other trouble.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Who says God's a comedian playing to an audience that's too scared to laugh?
Yeah. How old are you now, Steve? Do you mind if I ask?
I'm 28.
No, seriously. I mean, I just can't believe that you've survived such a long life. I mean, your first heart was 47, the first transplant, and now you just had another one, and it's amazing.
Yeah, it was 47, and I've had one 4 years ago. I'm 67 now.
Oh, wow. How long did you have to wait? I mean, or were you considered a urgency, obviously?
Well, that's a really, really good question. I live in New York. I live in Long Island, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And of the 50 states, New York is rated 50 for donation.
Mm-hmm.
We're the worst state in the nation. I say that with great shame.
Mm-hmm.
And my doctor came to me in the hospital and said to me, I want to send you to California. I have a friend there who can take care of you. She sent me to California because they have so many hearts there. People go from all over the world to California because they donate so much there. So I had to go to California, and I was told when I got there that my first wait was almost exactly a year. And this one, because of the way New York State was, they thought I'd have to wait at least a year and a half. And my doctors didn't think I had that, and I didn't. So they sent me off to California. And when I was there, they told me they actually had a patient who was there for 3 hours before he got his heart.
Wow.
Right. But that's not normal. But normally there, it's 3 to 6 weeks. But I got really sick while I was in the hospital. I actually caught what is it when the blood, you have that blood, you know, when your blood gets infected?
The staph.
Yeah, I had a blood staph infection, yeah, and it almost killed me. And so that threw me off.
Right.
But it took, I was in the hospital for 67 days. By the time I got out, I had to learn how to walk and everything again.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
Well, I got to say, well, you must cherish every minute of your life, I would think, you know, and I mean, you had not only a second chance, but a third chance, and probably a fifth chance, actually.
I've had more. I have been told, personally told, that I had a year to live three different times now.
Wow.
My parents were told twice. That's five. And in the year that I was waiting, I almost died five times.
Wow. How did you hang in? How'd you hang in there? Was it just pure fight inside you wanting to do it? Or, I mean, what was the will?
Since I was a child, I developed this thing where I realized that I was by myself. I was 5 years old, and I realized I'm by myself.
Yeah.
I'm the only one in here. My parents get to see me for 1 hour a day. They have no idea what's going on in here.
Right.
And I realized all that when I was five, and it just made me just determined.
Right.
And I just was a fighter. I just fought. And all the doctors all through my life have told me, I can't tell you how many times I've heard, the only reason why you're alive is because of you. So I just developed as a young age this idea that you put on your armor and you fight. And
right.
if you lose, you don't, at least you go down swinging.
Right. Now, when all this happens...
Hey, Steve, can I ask Steve a question, Joanne?
Sorry, Johnny. Yes, Johnny. Go
Steve,
ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm very curious about your near-death experiences. I know our audience really likes, you know, to hear about other people's, you know, paranormal experiences. Could you go into a little bit about what happened to you? Were you told to go back, or what was it like?
Yeah, I was told to go back. Yeah, I was told to go back.
You
I mean,
go,
it's,
go
it's,
the
too
whole...
long, it's too long to go into for here. It's in the book. It's in the book in detail.
Okay.
But I moved up through my ceiling in my bedroom when I was 17, you know, and I saw my mother in the backyard. I told her where she was, who she was talking to, how he was dressed. We both knew that it happened. There's this light that you want to get to, but you're in this incredible darkness, and it was incredibly crowded and incredibly cold, the coldest cold I've ever been, and the darkest dark I've ever seen. Mm. And it was so crowded. I likened it to like a Japanese commuter train. It was unbelievably crowded. Mm. And
what was it crowded with? Was it? Oh, okay.
Other people.
Yeah,
I'm trying to move through it to the light, but I can't go anywhere. Mm. And suddenly I felt the parting of the ways, you know, like the way a cop moves through a crowd.
Yeah.
Right. And I felt the wake of that. And suddenly there's a hand on my shoulder, even though I didn't have a shoulder. And this voice, and I've always described it this way, a voice that I've heard before, that I never heard before, but recognized. So if you can put that together, that's the only way I can put it together.
Was it male or female?
Very male.
Mm-hmm.
In a very beautiful, sweet,
gentle,
deep, gentle, with a smile on. You know how you can hear when somebody's smiling?
Yeah.
Said these exact words. No, go back. You're not ready yet.
Hmm. It's amazing.
And I went back. And, but that was my 17th birthday. That was maybe the best birthday present I have ever had.
Absolutely. Oh, my God. Yeah.
It taught me so much. When I was 17, I mean, I was already not afraid of death.
Right.
But by
right.
the time I was 17 and that happened to me, it was like turning me into the Energizer Bunny.
Yeah, because
you know, I'm not so many people are afraid of death, and it's really I hate to tell you, you're going to die. So why are you afraid of it?
You know what, Steve? I'm not afraid of dying. I'm afraid of breaking the hearts of my family.
Yeah, that's different, but that's what it is. That's the contract we come into this world with.
Yeah.
And I've told my doctors that if I'm in the hospital when it's like this, I want to be awake. I don't want to miss it. I'm waiting my whole life for this.
Hmm.
I really don't want to miss it.
Are you a religious guy, Steve? Very religious or normal?
I am religious in the sense that I am extremely religious, extremely spiritual, but not in a church. Because my beliefs, after everything I've been through, especially after my first transplant, is that when you can get a heart and you don't know who the donor is, and that heart could be from any color, any religion, anything, right? Suddenly, religion for me went out the window as far as a place you go with one creed.
Right.
Just went right out the window for me.
Right.
Especially when there's people will say, well, if you don't believe this way, you don't go to heaven. I have a real hard time with that. Mm-hmm. I have a real hard time with people not believing in an all-powerful God, and I have a hard time with people who don't believe in a forgiving God. I believe in both.
Now, since it was cold, do you think it was heaven?
No, I think it was hell.
Because it's supposed to be a beautiful experience, and you said it was cold and extremely dark.
Yeah, I was moving. I couldn't get to the light, I think, and all that crowd, I think. You know, Greek is hell is a Greek word, and it means absence of light.
Mm.
And my feeling from my brief experience is if you don't make it to the light, you're stuck there, and that's a bad place to be.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of people stuck there that day.
I'm going to tell you something, because I read a Bible passage afterwards, and it talked about the gnashing of teeth, and I heard it. I heard the gnashing of teeth. So, to me, you know, but I don't really...
Were you scared until you
At the beginning, I thought it was the most beautiful thing happening to me. It was just so... It was beautiful. It was the feeling, all the pain went away.
It just
was wonderful, but then as I started to slow down and get stuck in this bad place, I started to panic. I started to get really worried. I didn't want to be there, you know. And I was wondering what the heck could I have done at the age of 17 to land me there, you know.
Did you ever like say to yourself, "Guess who that voice was," or you just never tried?
It's a voice I recognize, but I never heard before.
Mm.
It was a very soothing voice. And I have a funny feeling I will be speaking with him again someday.
Of course, they're waiting for you when that person will be there for you again. Hopefully it'll be a warmer climate.
Yes, hopefully my dogs, my family, and my friends will be there.
Right, and not,
hey,
not hot like as it is now here.
Right.
Steve, I have another question for you. I've read some stories and some people who had different transplants and everything that sometimes they'll crave something that they didn't ordinarily crave before, or they kind of take on some of the personality of the organ that was from the person that was transplanted.
Okay.
Get any of that?
That is such a great question, and I really need to – I've always thought that was bunk. You know, like when I first got my first heart transplant, I love coffee, and I loved coffee then. I drank 2 or 3 cups a day at least when back then.
Mm-hmm.
After my transplant, I couldn't stand the taste of coffee. Couldn't stand it. Right away, my wife is going, "Oh my gosh, your donor must have hated coffee," and I don't believe that because you know it's just a heart. But they could put you on so many drugs.
Right.
Drugs that change you in ways,
right.
and I think it's really that you're on so much prednisone.
Mm.
That drug alone will do that. So you know, and prednisone will somebody, "Oh my gosh, she's drawing or she's swimming," but prednisone will make you uninhibited in ways that you might have been.
Right.
So maybe now you just had the courage to do this thing you never did before.
Mm-hmm.
So I never really bought that. And, you know, now I'm drinking coffee again. I was drinking coffee a short while afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that my tastes were changed by the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
However, and here's where I can't believe I'm saying this.
Mm-hmm.
After my second transplant, I'm laying in bed. My wife isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
I had just – it was horrific. My second transplant was absolutely horrific.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of things went wrong in that transplant, and I really genuinely suffered and was in genuine agony. People use the word agony, but they have no idea what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I had two doctors tell me I had the kind of pain that prisoners of war had.
Right.
So we're talking real pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm laying in bed, and all of a sudden, I'm shaking in my bed. I'm shaking side to side in my bed. I'm moved. I'm physically moved side to side quickly. As if somebody had grabbed me and was rocking me as hard as they could.
Hmm.
And I said out loud to myself, "What the, you fill in the blanks."
Right.
And I was like, "What the heck was that?"
Right.
And then all of a sudden it came to me, is my donor trying to communicate with me? And then it happened again. And to this day, I'm convinced that my donor was trying to tell me how he felt or something. And I'm convinced that it was my donor. I was physically moved in my bed. If you're having some kind of shakes or something, you go up and down. You don't go side to side.
Did your donor have a horrific ending?
No, he had a brain aneurysm. And after we found out that he'd had a brain aneurysm, my wife said to me, I can understand how he felt like that.
Right.
She's a nurse.
That's why I was asking, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that he was just letting me know he was there.
So let me ask you now about the donor and their family. Was it you that wanted to reach out to them, or they wanted to reach out to you? How did that work?
Okay, it's very hard for that to happen. What happens is as soon as I got back to my – because we had to have an apartment in L.A., of course.
Mm.
So as soon as I got home from the hospital, like on the second day, I was just in so much pain. But in the first couple of days, I wrote a letter to the family, and you send that to the OPO, the Organ Procurement Organization. And in this case, that was One Legacy in L.A., which is probably the best OPO in the country, or one of them, certainly. They're phenomenal. And I sent my letter to them. And then I think I sent a Christmas letter. And, no, I didn't hear anything back because you can't know their address. You can't know their name. You know nothing about them.
Yeah.
And then I got a phone call about a year later, 2 years later, I forget. Yeah, a little more than a year later, I get a phone call, and it's a lady from One Legacy telling me that she has a letter for me. Hey, do I want to get it?
Mm-hmm.
And it was from the family.
Mm.
And of course, I wanted to get it. Then it took forever for them to mail. I thought I'd get it in the next few days. It took a couple of weeks. I was going crazy.
Oh. Yeah.
But I got this big envelope with another envelope in it, and there was a handwritten letter by the donor's mother, and she wrote the letter because he had just been divorced just before he died. He had been had just gotten divorced, so she was next of kin. She was the one who made the decision. And she was the one who wrote the letter. It was a beautiful handwritten letter, beautiful letter.
Mm.
And then I got to meet them about a year later.
Mm. So tell us about that experience.
That is like one of the most bizarre things I've ever experienced in my life because it's very weird. You cannot help but feel guilty about it. You cannot help but feel. And I actually stood the spot where he collapsed. I mean, I held his ashes. I mean, that was really weird. But the mother wanted me to. His name was David Jacobo. The mother is Susan Jacobo. The father is David Jacobo. And he's got he left three children, four children, four beautiful children, a lovely, lovely family, lovely, lovely family, and the ex-wife and. Whose name is Isabel, the ex-wife and the mother both said to me separately, do not feel guilty. And both of them said separately, you're family now. And they are a lovely family, and I love them. And obviously they're generous. And obviously, you think about Susan and David's position when their son had just passed and they're asked, do you want him to be a donor? And they're saying yes. So you're talking about people who in the worst time of their lives, they just lost their child, the worst time of their life, they're saying yes, help somebody else.
Right.
That takes a lot of love, a lot of spirit, a lot of everything.
Yeah.
Everything that's good. And they are everything that's good. They're a fabulous family.
Well, I have two family members who have lost their children, and they donated their organs. And I'm not sure if they ever met the recipients, but
it's very rare. It's only 3% do. Actually, only 3% answer the letters. Like it's less who meet.
Excuse me. It's I don't know how they did what they did either, but I guess I would want it done for me if I could help somebody out. I mean, I don't need it if I'm not going to make it.
Exactly. You know, when I was the vice president of Transplant Speakers International, we used to travel all over the country in England, helping people learn about donation. I can't tell you how many donor family members, whether it was a wife, a husband, a mother, a father, a sister, or whatever, a family member, come up to me and say, you know, this donation is the only thing that made sense of a tragic incident. Mm. And because donors right now, the way the technology is, you know, most donors die from a sudden trauma. So nobody knew what was coming, you know, and it's always a shock.
Right.
And it's always something like, you know, David had an aneurysm, but it's usually like they fell off a ladder, they were in a car accident, they were shot, they were beaten, you know, it's something sudden.
Sudden.
And every, family after family has told me this is the only thing that made sense out of a senseless situation.
Mm.
Wow. You have to forgive me. I'm actually tearing up here.
I'm sure you are. You're breaking my heart, actually, because I know I don't know how my cousin and my sister-in-law did it with my nephews when they lost their sons. They both donated their organs as well. And how do you do it, you know? And when you meet the person, like, what was their reaction? Did they want to hear the heart? Were they happy?
Yes, they most of, it's really interesting. The mother, the ex-wife, the daughter, you know, David had a sister, and the children, and an aunt, all of them wanted to hear the heart. And all of them were female except for the two boys who listened. It was really weird. None of the men wanted to listen, but the women did. And my wife brought her stethoscope. My wife is a cancer nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And they all listened. And it was just really fascinating to watch their faces as they listened to the heartbeat of, you know.
Right.
You know, and you got to realize that the mother – Susan, you know, she's listening to the heartbeat, that one beat inside of her.
Exactly. Yeah. Amazing. Totally amazing story. My God. And now, before this all went down, or was this did this happen while you were working in TV, or no?
Oh, no, no. I had retired from television some years earlier. I had started a marketing business. And then I got sick, and then I was forced into retirement early. But you know, I'm still working. I'm doing this. I'm doing, you know, I'm doing the book. I'm about to write another book. I'm doing, I'm working hard. I'm trying to work with hospitals and trying to get, I'm on a mission where I'm trying to get patients to understand doctors and doctors and hospitals to understand patients better.
Mm.
And there's a real, I see a real disconnect between doctors and patients and hospitals and patients, and it's on both sides. You can say it's as much of the patient's fault as you can say it's the doctor's and the hospital's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Both sides are having trouble communicating to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to bridge that gap because I think it would make for better outcomes. I think the more that, you know, the more that hospitals understand patients and the more that patients understand doctors and where everybody understands where each other is coming from, they come to each other from very different points of view. And it's kind of understandable why there's so much. But, you know, you'll get a patient who maybe in the business world or in their social world, they're bossy. And that's how they get around. That's how they've survived, by being a boss, you know, by yelling at people and telling people what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that doesn't really work in a hospital setting, does it?
No.
It doesn't work like when a cop pulls you over and you start doing that to a cop. It doesn't work then either.
No.
Yeah, because I remember I teach at the police academy here about donation, and I remember talking to a friend of mine who got me in there, and I was like, I just can't believe that, you know, people would yell at a man with a gun, and he'd go, the heck with my gun, I have a pen. You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, you yell at me, I'm going to write you as many tickets as I can. If you don't yell at me and you're nice to me, I may let you off.
Right.
And it doesn't work in that situation. It doesn't work in a hospital situation either, because is that nurse and that doctor going to be inclined to really try to help you, or are they just going to give you the bare minimum that the job requires? They're only people. So if you're acting like that in the hospital, you're being kind of a dope, and you're not helping yourself. And patients need to understand that. They need to understand that they have to be kind, that they have to be friendly to the doctors and the nurses who are doing the best that they can. They all are like that. They want to be there, you know. So you want them to want to help you as a patient. That's your number one goal. How do I get these people to want to help me more than they want to help the next guy? That's your goal in a hospital. Now, the doctors, they have a tendency that they need to be aloof to protect themselves. And my feeling about that is, I've always said this, and, you know, I'm sorry, doctors and nurses, but too bad. You're the ones who pick this job, and your job is to connect with me. And if it's emotionally difficult for you, that's too bad. The patient needs it. One of the ways that doctors do that is they talk over the patient. Mm-hmm. So, and I thought it was because my wife is a nurse. Doctors tend to talk to my wife as if I'm not there. Mm-hmm. And I brought this up at a transplant meeting that I go to, and a guy said to me, I thought it was just me, and his wife wasn't a nurse. And then I found out from a friend of mine who's a doctor, he goes, doctors do that all the time. They won't talk to the patient. They talk to the spouse or to the family member, whatever, you know, works. And it's just the way that they do to protect themselves. But it makes the patient feel invisible. It hurts the patient's feelings. And it makes the patient less inclined to heal. And the whole point of the doctors don't understand that they're not the ones doing the healing. The patient is. And the patients don't understand that the doctor's not the one doing the healing. They're the ones doing the healing. So what needs to be done is that both the patient and the doctor have to grow an environment where the patient feels good about healing. Because the patient's the one doing the healing. The doctor may do the operation. They may prescribe the medicine. But the one doing the healing is the patient.
Let me ask you this. I wanted to ask you something else, but now that you said your wife is a nurse, when you were in the hospital, was your wife nitpicky about the nursing staff or how they were functioning in the hospital?
No. But first of all, in both hospitals that I've been to for my transplant, Columbia and Columbia Presbyterian in New York City and Cedars-Sinai in L.A., the nursing staff was phenomenal in both places. And my wife's not like that. I mean, now if she saw something wrong, she'd say something, but she would say it in a way that was like, or either I'm talking, you know, is in a way that would help me not get them mad at me.
Nice.
You know, and my wife, who I will never, I mean, I kid around about my wife. I mean, we're all married almost 30 years. I have to kid around, you know, but my wife never left my side. She slept in a chair for 5 days. I mean, she's just amazing. She never left me.
Well, I know I told you that I recently had surgery, and actually my partner is a nurse, and where I had the surgery done, I won't mention where it was done, but they were absolute idiots. They didn't speak a word of English. When I talked to them, I could barely speak, and I had to repeat myself 5 times. And then they asked me the question that I was telling them. So it was very, very stressful. But as my partner is a nurse, she is pinpointing and nitpicking. And I'm like, shut up. I have to stay here, not you.
Right, right.
Shut up.
She's not helping you.
Right, I understand.
She's not helping you.
I understand that what they're doing is wrong. However, shut up. And
right. There's a way
to
do it, and there's a way not to do it, you know?
Yes. I mean, and I just said, please go home. I didn't even want her there because she was making things worse for me, in my opinion, although she was being a professional, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
But like you said, it wasn't going to help me. So that's,
you know,
I'm sorry.
I had a doctor who was going to give me who was going to, I think, draw something from me, or probably blood, right? And he wiped me down with the alcohol, but the spot where he wiped and where he was going to use the needle were two different places.
Mm-hmm.
And so just to show you how you can do this. Now, this is an MD, and I'm a patient, right? But I don't think a doctor's any better than me. I don't think anybody's any better than me, because we're all equal. So, you know, that's the end of it. We're all equal, you know.
Right.
Beyond that, shut up. I'm like you with that. But before he got the needle there, I said, excuse me, doctor. He goes, yes. I said, do you mind wiping that with alcohol again, please? I just said it like that. Would you mind wiping that with alcohol again,
right,
please?
Right.
And he went, oh, sure, certainly. And he did. Mm. It was no problem. You know, it wasn't. He wasn't insulted. He wasn't anything, you know. And he might have even realized why I asked it. He might have realized, oh, gosh, I'm going in the wrong place from what I just – because he was probably distracted because he's got so much on his mind.
Right.
So I didn't have to be nasty to him or anything. I was just nice to him.
Oh, no, no. She wasn't nasty about it.
No, I'm talking about the way some patients – I didn't mean, you know –
I'm just saying, I didn't want any problems, so she wasn't nasty about it, but don't, you know, leave them alone and let them do their job. You're not at your hospital. I understand what they just did was wrong. I saw it, too. Let me say it, not you.
Exactly.
You know, and so anyway, with the COVID, she couldn't stay long anyway, so it was okay. So, but the real question I did want to ask, now, knowing that your heart, the new heart, has an expiration date. How do you treat yourself differently?
Well, now that I'm as old as I am, I mean, I walk down the street and there are rocks that say hello to me. You know, it's, I mean, the lifespan of this heart is it. And who knows? I might, you know, I might crash my car. I might get run over by a bus. You know, I mean, who knows when it is or what it's going to be. So, you know, if this heart were to last 15 years, that would put me, you know, in my 70s. And for somebody who was supposed to die when he was 5, I can't complain.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
You know, my life is going to be whatever it's going to be, just like it is for anybody else.
Right. Now, your bravado and attitude now, did you have the same attitude then? Or no, the heart transplant totally changed your outlook in regards?
No, I've always been a fighter in the hospital. I've always been, you know, come and get me, death. I've been like that since I was a child. I really go through that in the book. I mean, I used to dare death as a child, and I used to understand that I was in a battle with death. And since the age of 5, I have been developing strategies that I use actively whenever I go into the hospital, whenever I see a doctor. I don't walk into a hospital without having strategies in my head, even if I'm going for a visit, you know, to visit for my doctor visit. I go in with strategies. I'll just give you a real quick one that I mean, this is a really minor one, but the morning of my going into Cedars to, you know, to get my second heart transplant, I shaved my arms, I shaved my chest, because they're going to put tape all over me.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And the nurse who was giving me my first injection, she goes to me, did you shave? And I went, yep. And she goes, smart boy. But that's what I mean. I actively try to see what can I do to make things better for me.
Right. Right. Well, so it wasn't your first rodeo, so you
no.
That.
But anybody who's going to go into any kind of situation, your goal should be making this. How can I get them to want to help me? How do I? What do I do? What do I need to do? What strategies do I need to help me survive?
Right.
Well, everything. I mean, I and that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because I have all these strategies and people kept telling me you need to share these.
Mm-hmm. Now, other than author, I mean, you're a director, producer. You were a writer with Videography Magazine. I mean, you're also written scripts. I mean, anything we would know, and you're also a songwriter. Anything we would know?
There was a disco. I had a minor disco hit. It was titled by us on Dancing Trip. I forget what it was really called. It was by Joyce Thorne. That actually made the disco charts for about four and a half seconds. but you know, I mean, in television, I did a lot of stuff. I was in television for a long time. I mean, one of the jobs that I was on was, remember when Nixon wrote his book, The Nixon Memoirs, and it was on. They had an interview with him that showed up on 60 Minutes and Charles Kuralt.
Yeah.
I was one of the guys on that. And And do you remember the Star magazine commercials?
Yeah.
I did all of those.
Oh, wow. Mm.
Yeah. So, I mean, I did a lot of industrials, too, a lot.
Right. Now, did you also do work with Joan London and Cyndi Lauper, Richard Lewis, or no?
Yeah. Joan London, she had a cable show called Mother's Day.
Mm.
And I worked that show. And I worked Cyndi Lauper. I met her on what's her name? Good Sex with Dr. Ruth.
Oh, Dr. Ruth Westheimer.
Yes, she was a panic, and I loved her, and we all loved her. She was a riot. And I at one time I was working on the number 1, 2, and 3 cable shows. That was when cable was first starting.
Yeah.
And so, everybody thinks everything happens in L.A., but cable started in New York. All the cable shows started in New York. And one of the shows, and it's really funny, a lot of the shows that I did became networks. So Lifetime Network started as a show called Lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Good Housekeeping started as a show.
Mm-hmm.
There were several of others, and I worked most of those. And it was a group of us who worked all those cable shows.
Mm. Wow. So you've had a wonderful life, that's for sure. To have it twice is amazing. I mean, that's just fabulous.
Well, that's just the choice, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, we choose the path we make. I always say life isn't hard. It's the choices we make that make it hard. You know, that's my opinion. The choices that we make in life that make our life hard. Life is easy if you choose the right way to do it, you know. I mean, hey.
And if you win the lotto, that helps.
That helps a lot, too. It really does. Yeah. They say money doesn't buy happiness. If it brings misery, I'll take it.
You know what? It may not buy happiness, but it'll buy you a Ferrari, so okay.
Well, Steve, where can everybody get your book?
Amazon's easy. Barnes & Noble has it, but I guess the easiest shot is it's all over the place. It's on all the book-selling places online.
Mm.
But I would say the majority of my books – I've had a lot of people tell me they get it at Barnes & Noble, but I would say the majority of people get it at Amazon.
Amazon. What's your next book you're working on? Can you discuss it or no?
Yeah, because things went so horribly wrong in L.A., and it was the second transplant, and there was also something else that happened with the donor in me, not just the thing with the shaking of the bed.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to go into those things, and I wanted to go more into the strategies and more into what hospitals and doctors and patients need to do with each other, you know. So I'm still trying to figure out the title of that book, but I'm probably going to do that pretty soon. And I'm doing other things. Like I said, I'm really trying to get the word out as far as a speaker, as far as working with the hospital so that I could talk to doctors and talk to patient groups,
mm-hmm.
you know, and make it so everybody can make it easier on themselves. And I want to improve patient outcomes, and
right.
That's a big deal. Improving the patient outcomes is can really help.
Exactly.
I hope. That's what I want to do. I just want to help.
Oh, it does. It does, because you just lay in there. I mean, I was in dire pain myself. I just wanted to go home. I they weren't doing anything for me. I was just laying there in pain. Let me go in my own bed and be in pain. I mean, you know, so it's like, I know they have to monitor you. And, of course, you know, I didn't even ask for the pain meds. They came in. They knew I was dying. They came in every 4 hours. Here you go. I didn't even have to ask. They knew what I was going through. So, but, oh, my God. Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us. John, did you have anything else you wanted to ask Steve before we hang up?
No, just it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating story.
Yeah, we definitely got to get the book and read about his life experience? What do you call it? Out of body experience. Thank you. Sorry, couldn't.
Yeah. And of course, don't you want to miss by being a glider pilot either?
What is that?
You know, I used to fly gliders.
Oh, that's in there too.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, what else do you do other than what we've mentioned?
Right now, I'm just an old man sitting at home in front of his computer a lot of the day working.
Oh. You sound like you're 25.
I try to be. I keep telling everybody I'm a Toys R Us kid, and I think that's part of the you have to have an attitude if you want to stay young.
Yeah, that's right.
You have to have a young attitude, or you're not gonna. You know, I mean, I went to one of my school reunions some years ago, and I could not believe how many of my schoolmates who were my age were old. And there was a group of us who weren't old, and there was a group of them who were, and it was all attitude.
But you know what's funny? At the reunions, it's mostly the guys that look the oldest. The women don't age that much.
I don't know. You didn't go to my reunion. I would say it was 50-50.
At my reunions, I noticed that most of the men, they were either extremely overweight, bald. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with that, but when you're talking about the person who was, the head of the football team or whatever, it was Mr., you know, everybody wants to be with, and here he shows up looking like, who the hell is that, you know?
I know. It's really alarming, isn't it? It's kind of alarming. And then you're like, who the heck are all these old people? And you realize you're just as old as they are, you know?
Funny. It is funny. I think I'm coming up for one. I don't know when. I don't know. Who knows?
I'm looking at you sitting at a pair of drums here.
You see me at a pair of drums?
Yeah, you're sitting at a drum set.
Right now?
No, I'm looking at my computer. I see you in a photograph sitting in front of a drum set.
Oh, I wish I could get behind the drums right now. I'm barely sitting here talking to you.
Is that how you know Jeff Gans?
Who?
Jeff Gans. He's one of your friends on Facebook.
Jeff. Oh, my God.
Bass player.
I have so many friends on Facebook because of the show. They've either been guests or they're future guests or... Jeff, it doesn't sound familiar. It doesn't sound like we've talked lately.
Okay.
The name doesn't sound familiar. I'll have to look him up now and tell him to come on the show.
He's a great, but great bass player. Joanne's been with a lot of big groups.
Joanne's a musician.
Yeah, I'm actually a musician. John's actually a movie director.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I make B grade horror movies.
That's one of my favorite. My favorite genre is exactly.
Well,
I love
there
them.
Go. There you go. No, we just do this for fun because we love it, talking to people and getting to know people and, sharing their stories and helping promote whatever you guys need to promote. And just
I'm glad for it. I really, really appreciate your having me. I really do. I appreciate it a lot.
I wish somebody had done this for me when I was starting out years ago, but they don't, you know, with the technology the way it is, anybody can do it. So we do it because we love it.
Awesome. I really appreciate it.
Steve, I don't know. I think your story would make a fantastic movie. I really do.
Well, if you feel like that, I'd be happy to work with you on it.
Yeah, you guys are
so awesome. If you work with me, it'd be a horror movie, though.
Well, if you work with me, you'll have two horror movies, right?
Oh, my God. Well, thank you so much, Stephen Taibbi. Thank you. Grateful Guilt, Living in the Shadow of My Heart. Pick it up, guys. Amazon, anywhere you could, any fine online store or bookstore, you can find it. I want to go pick it up because I got to read more about this. But Stephen, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure getting to know you. Wish you well, stay healthy, and hopefully we can talk again soon.
I would love that, Joanne. Thank you so much. I'm going to friend you today, right now.
Oh, thank you, Stephen.
Thanks, Steve.
And John, thank you so much too. You had, both of you asked some very good questions. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks
for coming on. We appreciate it. Take care, Stephen.
All right. Good night now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Steve.
Doesn't this book sound great? I mean, it's got...
Yeah, I want...
The out-of-body experience.
Yeah, that's what I want to read about, too. So I'm going to pick it up and read that. That's just amazing.
And he thinks he was in hell. That's what's crazy. You know?
Well, everyone has different... that's the first time I've ever heard about it being like a... almost like a
rally.
Train car going... Yeah, I never heard that before.
Said,
they always say...
It was kind of like the people who couldn't get to the light. If you couldn't get to the light,
yeah,
you were screwed. You're stuck. And that's hell, I guess, if you can't make it to the light. And all those people were trying to get to the light. I don't know. That was my take on it. I don't know.
That's
but, I mean,
it's an interesting story.
Very fascinating. Well, thank you very much, Stephen Taibbi, for joining us. And we apologize again to Julia Benjamin for not joining us tonight. We will reschedule, Julia, I promise. And thank you to our sponsors. Real quick, we'll say goodnight. To the High Bar and Bistro in Garfield, New Jersey. They have pickup, takeout, delivery, and some limited seating due to social distancing in Garfield, New Jersey. Delicious food, Precious Memory Video in Kenton, Israel, Pennsylvania. KWB Wines in South Africa. Tees for the Times and Other Stuff in Clifton, New Jersey. Syntech Productions in Lenoka Harbor, New Jersey. Oleander Public Relations in Texas. Take a Break from Cancer.org for Pete's sake. And Joey Mack's Hot Dog Truck and Cafe in Harrison, New Jersey. They also do pickup and delivery and have limited seating too for those folks who want to go and hang out and have. They had supposedly have delicious kibasi. I'm not a kibasi fan, so I couldn't tell you. But dogs, they got great dogs, great hot dogs. What's their phrase, John? I keep forgetting. Oral satisfaction, oral satisfaction guaranteed. Why don't we be the judge of that? They actually sent us some stuff that we have to give away, some T-shirts and some free food, some coupons for free food. So we'll be giving them away at future shows. For the month of August, we don't know what we're going to do. We have a couple of guests booked. Maybe we'll just keep those shows, John, see how we do. What do you think, honey?
Yeah, it's up to you. It's up to how you feel, Joanne.
Yeah, I gotta go lay down really bad. So, thank you all. We appreciate it. Thank you, John. I love you. Have a good night. Thank you, Stephen Taibbi, author of Grateful Guilt: Living in the Shadow of My Heart. Take care, everybody.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, Johnny. Good night, Johnny boy. Night.